If you don't like capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want?
And there is a great deal of new construction of new institutions, new forms, new cooperatives, new worker-owned companies that's happening all over the country.
This is the Gar Alperovitz Podcast, a regular look at the ideas of historian and political economist Gar Alperovitz as he explores strategies to democratize wealth and empower workers and communities.
What's up, nerds? This is bank dork Alexis Goldstein here with my economics dweeb co-host, Jesse Meyerson, for episode 12 of Disorderly Conduct, our twice-a-month podcast with Tarbell NYC.
And then last, we're going to bring you an interview with political economist Gar Alperovitz about what we must do to move America beyond capitalism.
Here we go.
What follows is a series of excerpts from a discussion that I had with Gar Alperovitz, who is a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, College Park. It was recorded in a sort of noisy restaurant environment, and so I apologize for the audio quality and also for having it broken up in the following way. Gar Alperovitz is the author of America Beyond Capitalism and most recently What Then Must We Do? And I started the conversation out by asking him please to explain the basis of and the process by which he generated the work of his life, which he's been working on for decades, which he calls a pluralist commonwealth.
Well, the beginning point is, if you don't like corporate capitalism, you don't like state socialism, what do you want? And that question has been flowing from the collapse of from the Soviet Union, and in theory, or if you go back to Rosa Luxemburg, and people like Panikov were asking these questions long ago, that centralized state socialism has obvious disadvantages. But on the other hand, market forms of ownership are another problem, because you run into the market even if you turn people into worker capitalists in many situations. So is there a model? And what does it look like beyond abstraction? I come out of the, this is the 60s when I first got interested in these questions. I mean, I'd had a lot of experience at public level and working in the government, and then the 60s hit and I changed my life. But that becomes a realistic question, because both in terms of a genuine problem and also in terms of a political movement building, because unless you have a clarity about some direction and know something about the obstacles, you're in trouble. So it was an attempt initially to begin to sketch out a theoretical view of a systemic design that began to challenge both of the traditional models and also challenge straight worker ownership models. So that's the origins of it, and I think what the first one is probably 1972 or something, when I first published something in the Journal of Radical Economics. I can't recall exactly where I put the first one out. So that was the genesis. And ever since then, I've tried to learn something in the last 30, 40 years about more refined aspects of that. And try to develop pieces of it as well. So there's both the design question, but also what do the specific elements look like if you get serious, rather than if you get away from rhetoric and you start getting serious about it. So that's what's been happening.
So I asked him to detail some of the mechanisms by which a pluralist commonwealth system would democratize power and wealth.
Well, I mean, you basically work from the principle of subsidiarity, which is the Catholic Church principle, but everybody knows it. In other words, keep it at the smallest level possible, unless for technical or technological or other reasons you have to go up. So starting at the local level, there is a role in small markets for worker co-ops and other co-ops. So it depends where you draw the line, and we don't know a lot about that. But let's assume that there is a whole realm of small worker co-ops in any system. There's also functional questions. So for instance, if you look at land ownership, that usually is geographic. So that's, what does that mean? Geographic structures that own and control land as capital on behalf of communities. So that's a community-wide structure rather than a worker structure or a consumer structure or possibly a state structure. So that's a functional relationship. That's why the term pluralist commonwealth. There's lots of plural forms. When you actually get beyond rhetoric, there are plural forms. Another one would be public utilities, citywide, or even larger than that, region-wide. the Tennessee Valley Authority in its initial form was really interesting. There were going to be seven of them at least. And that was ecologically oriented, regional structure to manage both the river system and power base. And they were going to be all over the country. It got taken over partly because of World War II, partly because of the power structure. But it was a regional structure to try to deal with ecology as well as ownership of capital. So starting at the local level, you move to land in certain areas, some citywide or large neighborhood areas, then to states, regions, and nation for different reasons. I don't know how much you know about the Evergreen Cooperatives in Cleveland. Well, that's an application of some of the principles. It is a geographic community, 40,000 in the neighborhood, very poor, largely black. In that structure, you have a community-wide nonprofit corporation, in theory benefiting the community, and on that are hung worker-owned companies. So it's complex. The structure at the local level is this community-wide, but integrating worker-owned cooperatives. The next level up is hospitals and universities, all of which have large-scale taxpayer money. So if you actually reflect on that, what you've got is a planning system using quasi-public purchases to stabilize the market of a community-building, worker-owned complex. So it's somewhat, it draws on some of Mondragon, but Mondragon never had the planning aspect, never was a system. Mondragon wasn't interested in changing the system. It was interested in helping Basque people, and it works in the global market. This is an attempt to begin looking at systemic planning models as well as how you organize communities and workers in different relationships. So there's a lot more in that model. Hopefully there'll be many, many more variations to improve it, because that was a beginning variation, and it by no means answers all the questions you'd want to answer. But it gives you a sketch that you can begin to think about for larger scale development. So pluralist commonwealth begins. The other piece about it is, and this is Luxembourgian, it is community building and nurturing geographically with a view to creating a culture of community that can nurture and sustain and counter market forces and bureaucratic forces.
I asked him to elaborate on this idea of creating a culture of community.
Yeah, if you start with worker ownership, the tendency is the workers have to protect themselves against the market or the planners. So it is not at the exclusion of others as well. They are forced to be defensive of themselves. Or to put it another way, it has very little to do with equality. That is to say, the workers who own the garbage industry and the workers who own the oil industry are on very different footing in terms of power and inequality of the system. So if you really go to a worker-owned model and leave it at that, you get very different cultures, protect ourselves, and you get different interest groups drawing upon their power base. So people attempt to correct for this, you know, by saying, well, we'll pass laws that'll balance out the inequalities or the ecological aspect. And it's, from my point of view, that the political economy of that is really very thin, because they've developed political power, vested power, that's going to protect interests. So how do you get beyond that in terms of structure, as well as the slow nurturing of a culture of different reflection and of each other? So that's why the community aspect becomes really critical, because if you can do it, and it's not been pulled off. You know, the best you could do were some of the early Israeli kibbutzim, which had very interesting models, and I gather some of that's coming back for different reasons. There's a long story about the role of the right-wing governments in nailing the kibbutzim. But if you can do that, you begin to generate norms and cultural norms that can, in theory, help nurture and permeate the system to counterbalance the inevitable tendencies for different groups to protect themselves against the market or the planners. So that becomes a really critical aspect. What is the unit? What is the base unit, and how do you build it? Within that, I mean, as I said, there's plenty of room for even small businesses, entrepreneurial and small businesses that can come up with innovations and worker firms. But what is the larger structure? So pluralist commonwealth both reflects the notion of different forms under different land, worker, community, co-ops, region, some national planning. So there are different forms of ownership that are attached to each one of those, plural forms of common ownership. but also different organizations of scale. So that's kind of the sketch, real quick sketch.
I was curious about the role of the welfare state in a pluralist commonwealth, so I asked about the basic things that I think need some sort of social provision, which is to say education, healthcare, pensions, and some sort of basic income.
Those ideas were always good ideas. There was nothing wrong with them, except that the political economy of them under corporate capitalism didn't work and is failing more and more because the power relationships to get the resources out of the system just aren't there. So, yes, healthcare, education, pensions, those are the most obvious ones. It's available to us. The other piece of this, rarely discussed on the left and really a big hole, is the issue of liberty. What are the institutional requirements of liberty? And, you know, it's a little bit complex because, you know, the left should have addressed this given the failures of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. But what does it take? The right wing actually had a theory, and their theory was that everybody should have a plot of land, a farm, or a small business, and that gave them sufficient security so they could be independent of the state. It was a theory of liberty. The left didn't articulate one. But the notion of guaranteed annual income or guaranteed annual job or tenure, which is really what that is a preservation of liberty, not just a welfare state kind of way to provide income. So yes, those issues would be central to a serious state.
So I was concerned that while we were creating this excellent pluralist commonwealth, it would be on the backs of the global south. So I asked Alperovitz to talk about the international implications for the pluralist commonwealth.
Well, Thad Williamson and I did a book on this called Making a Place for Community, in which we tried to extend some of the principles and trade policy in the direction of supporting community building from the bottom up pluralist visions. But the way I come at it, and I think this is the question over the next three decades, and I need to say that at an early point in my career, I was in the government. I worked in the House, in the Senate. I ran this, Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day. I was his legislative director. And for a while, I did policy planning for the United Nations. And then the Vietnam War happened, and I moved elsewhere. But what is at stake is, and this is really the way I think about it, if you attempt to use the United States power to be positive in global affairs, you come up against the system is designed not to. So the first step in organizing the power of the system to support a different vision globally is get our own act together. And that's really critical because there is no way, I mean, what they used to do in the State Department, somebody come up with a great AID program for some poor country. And indeed, people were, you know, genuinely positive in their vision and hope. By the time it got to the ground, the corporate interests had controlled it, because the power structure was sufficiently powerful to ruthlessly undermine whatever you wanted in their direction. So the lesson of that is the most important thing we can do, I think, in global affairs now is get, one, get off their backs, but two, rebuild a culture and institutional structure that would allow us to use the enormous resources that we have in a way to nurture and support other people. But I don't see shortcuts. I think, you know, so long as the system is structured as it now is, you're running up against very powerful interests that control, you know, you can back off, but control what you can do internationally. So back down would be. Now, obviously, I think the vision has, you know, implications for other ways of going about it. But I'm very cautious about that. Now, you can see the design that's being developed in Latin America. Sketches of the same principles, community, cooperative, decentralization, in the case of Venezuela, planning through the energy system. So everybody's beginning on the ground, very primitive explorations, by the way. They're very, very slow development of what's actually going on. But the principles are very similar of where you go. Because neither state dominant, nor simply worker ownership, building community, building from the bottom up, and only going to different levels. So I'm very supportive of that. But from an American point of view, I suspect we aren't going to be able to do much until we get our own act together.
The natural next question is, what does it take to get our act together? But I just want to interject one more question before we get to the question of political strategy, which is about the ecological implications. Because you've mentioned that a couple of times. You mentioned that you were Gaylord Nelson's legislative director, and Obviously, that is the supreme question, without which none of the other questions matter. So talk about the interactions between the ecology of the environment and Thurlow's Commonwealth as a political economic model.
Well, there's lots of dimensions. The most obvious one that we talked about a little earlier is the rebuilding a culture. And that is the culture from the bottom up that has not only that we talked about democratizing wealth, which is the central principle in all this. Bringing that together with an ecological vision is a community concept, not necessarily either a worker or a capitalist concept. Because that's exactly what happens when you do simply worker ownership or state ownership. Worker ownership in a situation where there's competition between worker groups, and particularly when there are gains from advancing scale, efficiencies of scale, the market forces people to exude costs. So if you're interested in ecological issues, you're trapped. You can say, we'll pass a law to take care of that, but then you're back into the political economy of power. It doesn't work. So you need a unit that integrates, and that is a communal unit. In other words, a unit that includes everybody is a community unit, including workers, people who stay at home for one reason or another, that it may be spouses or maybe elderly or maybe sick or children in school. The complex of the community as a whole is the necessary context in which ecological issues can be formed. So you're building from the bottom up. That's one way to come at it. The other is, I don't see, at the national level, for some industries, you're going to have to nationalize them. And, you know, there's been a discussion of nationalization or global socialism, there's been even a talk of. But the truth is, the cultures of large institutions, either public or private, are not at all necessarily ecologically oriented. They may stop the capitalist pressures to exude, but the bureaucrats still have other pressures to climb or grow or expand, and those are endemic to the system. So unless you rebuild the culture ecologically from the bottom up, you're trapped, even though you may need large institutions. How you actually control that requires a reconstruction from the bottom up. So I'm a both-and guy. We're going to need some national, but unless you really focus not only on the bottom, but the structure of the bottom, it's critical, I think.
Next, we talked about political strategy, how to get there, what the plan was going forward over the next 30 years.
I think it's important to say at least 30 years, because it, all of a sudden it opens up possibilities. I sometimes say when, talks I give, you want to play this game, the chips are decades of your life. Don't bother otherwise if you don't understand that this is a historical development process. I am cautiously optimistic, or at least I'm not pessimistic. I'm too much of a historian to be totally pessimistic. What I think is why I think this is the most interesting period of American history that I've lived through, and maybe the most interesting period, including the American Revolution and the Civil War, is as follows. I think the system, there's several ways to say it. I think they ran the system in the 19th century. When they ran into trouble, they just, quote, go west. In other words, kill Indians and take land. But the main power base of the system was, and the escape valve was, when in trouble, take land, until they ran out of land. And in the 20th century, not by design, but de facto, when they ran into trouble, there were massive wars. World War I came, recession, probably depression in 1914 was leaning that way. And boom, World War I. I don't think they designed it, but they solved that problem. Then World War II pulls them out of the depression. The Cold War, the Vietnam War, all of the Korean War handles the third quarter without the usual political questions being raised. They could manage the system. Besides, the Allies, their former competitors were destroyed. You have run out of land, and you've run out of war. You can't have nuclear war. Nuclear war ends it. We're not going to see mass armies on the ground. So there is a context in which the traditional solutions, the economic problems of the system, are political economic problems, are disappearing. On the other hand, which means increasing pain and increasing disillusionment, increasing ideological questioning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, the system doesn't collapse, which is really interesting, very unusual. In 1929, the percentage of government in GDP was 11%. It's now 34%, 33%, depends on when you measure it. So the system may decay, but not collapse. I mean, I, I challenged Krugman on this 3 years ago. I said, it's entering stagnation. Now they're all talking stagnation and political stalemate. It's a really interesting context. Stalemate and stagnation is very different from the pendulum swing reform or collapse, because it gives you time to build. It gives time on the one hand for disillusionment and decay and rethinking, but also how you can slowly build from the bottom up over time, so you're actually building something worth building. I mean, a crisis would either take you way crazy to the right, most likely, or crazy to the left, most likely to the right.
Yeah, they got the guns.
They got the guns, probably so. Almost certainly so. But, we have known cases where it went to the left.
I suspect that if there was some sort of collapse, it would be regional breaking apart.
That's...
I can think of one or two that would have some pretty severe regular governments.
For sure. Well, Texas would go fast. Yeah. And that's endemic of the regional question, how these things move. But on the other hand, the Hispanic community over 30 years, that's why the 30-year number is important. So, I mean, what I see the emerging context as generating... What I think is really interesting about the emerging context, and one can get analytic and historic about it, really is very interesting context in which the system doesn't collapse, but also doesn't reform, which means people are forced to reassess and think, and people, young people in particular, going through, this ain't what I expected. And all over the country, there's something wrong. That's what the new economy movement's playing around with. It's beginning to deal in that context. And I don't think people realize how important the context is, and that what people experience is the pain of it and the disillusion of it. But what it really is opening up systemic questions in a way that maybe you can build and learn how to do this stuff. It's not like it comes automatically to rebuild institutions. And if you don't build and learn it as you go, what happens is crisis and you create some monster. So it's a very, very positive, very interesting. Now, that's the positive outlook. I mean, it could all decay and violence will occur. I mean, violence is certain to occur. And the question is whether or not we're scattered and sporadic or overwhelming and centralized, producing fascism. It's a big enough country, so possibly it'll be sporadic and decentralized. That's the hope. And repression will be scattered, and enough space is allowed to keep building. But it could go the other way. But I think the conditions are really interesting in ways that people haven't realized or haven't contextualized the movements that are beginning to build.
Thanks for listening to the Gar Alperovitz podcast. To find articles, interviews, audio, video, and more, go to www.americabeyondcapitalism.com.